I think you should ask a number of people the stories of the G.J. LaPierre Award, because they will all be humorous. But they were remodeling the Tantalus facility across the way. And occasionally, the SRC would have parties on Friday afternoon. These would be beer parties, generally. Sometimes there would be brats associated with them. And they were rebuilding a concrete wall over at Tantalus. And a huge thunderstorm came in and blew in a lot of rain into the facilities. And Jerry LaPierre from Montana State came back to the Tantalus facility, and he found about a foot of water in the storage ring vault. Now, with all of the electrical equipment and everything around there, he was tremendously worried about what to do. And so he called the Stoughton Fire Department. Well, it's a volunteer fire department. And so when they heard the siren going off and they saw all the trucks coming over to the Tantalus site, all of the previously somewhat inebriated members of the SRC staff went over as well. And at that time, there was just a plank from one side of the foundation to the other that you had to walk to get into that facility. And Ed Rowe was one of the first to reach there because he was really concerned about it, and he fell off the plank and into the water. Well, they managed to get all of the electrical equipment off the ground, so nobody was electrocuted and none of the equipment was damaged. But the rainwater had washed some of the fresh concrete into a fold in the plastic that was over some of the equipment. And that's the shape of the concrete. And Ed, as a joke, decided that he would create the G.J. LaPierre Award for those who had undergone tremendous adversity in the accomplishment of their research. And so there is the ring, there's a plaque that has the ring sides on it, and there's this concrete thing, and the line in Kugel was to suggest that there was a beer party when this thing was created. They're interesting stories. Each year at the annual meeting, they would present the G.J. LaPierre Award to whomever had done the most to accomplish their research. The most humorous one was Mort Tromm from AT&T, and his name is on the list. And you will also see a big clamp on the Tantalus Award. Well, when Mort was working on a piece of his equipment, he had that big clamp on a table holding his equipment in place, and he was soldering a lead to it. And somehow he bumped the table, and the clamp came loose and grabbed him in the most inappropriate place of all. And Mort, with the presence of mind, did not grab the clamp. He grabbed his equipment and got it safe, and then he grabbed the clamp. And they had to take him to the hospital, actually, because he was tremendously bruised by that. But to hear Ed tell that story, it's just humorous as hell. That is adversity.
So is that the clamp?
That is the clamp, boy. Morton was more than willing to give it to the facility after that. Mine came because I got a sabbatical from Wisconsin. And Wisconsin does not have a sabbatical program, or at least it didn't back at that time. And I used my sabbatical for this National Academy study of synchrotron radiation facilities. And it was undoubtedly the worst time I have ever spent scientifically, because you had the East Coast and you had the West Coast fighting with each other, and they were determined to take funding away from the middle of the country. And the funding agencies were saying, we have enough money for all three. But they continued to fight, and they continued to bombard me from the center. But we eventually prevailed, and they retained funding for this Alaffy facility. And so Ed figured that I had deserved the G.J. Lapeer Award.
And when was that?
It was in 76. You've got all the dates on everyone. One of my students, Susan Johannesmeyer, she's now Susan Olesik, was doing work with ammonia. We were doing photoionization with ammonia. She had a liquid nitrogen baffle that was helping the pumping because liquid nitrogen would allow the ammonia to condense. And she finished her experiment and left to go home and realized that she had turned off the liquid nitrogen. And that meant whatever ammonia was in that container was going to evaporate and the pressure was going to rise enormously. So she almost got to Madison and realized that and turned around and was doing 85 miles an hour when the Verona police stopped her for speeding. And by the time she got back to the lab, the ammonia had indeed stopped being a condensed vapor and was a gas and had blown out the vacuum tube and had filled the whole facility with ammonia. So her adversity was getting a speeding ticket while trying to save her. These just funny stories.
Yeah.
Ed provided some life to the place by looking for people who really had pushed hard but still had managed to accomplish their research. So the G.J. Lapeer Award should be in your
Oh, absolutely.
Mort died of a heart attack, unfortunately. He was an extremely good scientist and a very, very nice guy. But he would always turn red when they tell a story about his trials. So what else would you like to know?
How about some, we kind of touched on the whole spectrum. We started at the beginning in 68 when you said you started working here, and then 97 to 2001 you said you'd work there, and then you mentioned 76 when you got your award. Maybe you could talk more about what research you did here or more of the administrative.
Well, the research I did, I started out with photoionization mass spectrometry. So we were using the photons, and the advantage to that was with a monochromator, you can tune the energy very precisely. With electrons, you get a broad distribution. With photons, you can get a very narrow distribution so that you can look at various energy states as you ionize the molecule. Our problem was that we were working with gas molecules with a storage ring that operates 10 to the minus 10 torr.
And this is a tantalus, correct?
Tantalus. And so trying to find a way to get gas at high pressure in one place and no gas at another place was pretty much a problem. And then we went from there to photoelectron spectroscopy, where we irradiated with photons and looked at the energy of the electrons that came off. And photoelectron spectroscopy is a major thing that's still being done. It's primarily being done here with surfaces and with molecular species absorbed on surfaces. We were doing our work in the gas phase. Then I moved into the Center for Nanotechnology, where we were looking at huge polymers, and we were looking at the ways that the photons could be used to break a polymer. And the idea behind that, it's very easy. You would take a solid material, metal generally, and put it on top of a wafer that had a photoresist on it. And where you irradiated, you would break the polymer bonds, and then you could take a solvent and wash away that polymer. And then you could begin to put metal down on the silicon surface, and you could make a pattern. This is, you could make a microcircuit originally, and finally a nanocircuit when we finished with it. So I've been associated with the ring in terms of research since 1968. And I did my last work in 2005.
Okay.
I've been on the users advisory committee for a very long time. I was on the committee that tried to figure out some ways to make the ring work when we put the Microtron in place. And I've been the associate director for the Center of Nanotechnology since 1984. So I've been research and administration the whole time.
Okay. And you said you're in the users? The users committee. So what
users advisory committee. One of the, I'm going to think of a way to say this kindly. Ed felt as if he created the synchrotron radiation center himself. He had a lot of help, but he considered it his baby. And he spent a lot of time listening to users and trying to accommodate users. But as the place got bigger and bigger, that became less easy to do. And so users who always wanted more time got upset when the accelerator group took time to do their studies. And so there began to be a disagreement over time, a disagreement over priorities. And so a users advisory committee was formed, and it was primarily to advise the director on research that should be done and research time allocation. I think if you were to ask any scientist, there's never enough time for them to do their work. But since there are only certain hours of day that the ring would be operating, then we had to find some way of having proposals reviewed, and then time allocated. Users Advisory Committee would also advise the director when somebody got really upset with their time allocation. Generally, the ring used to operate 840 MeV from essentially 8 in the morning until midnight. And then we instituted operating the ring at 1 GeV from midnight to 8 a.m., only 5 days a week. Some users, when they would come in and spend a week, week and a half getting set up, getting their samples ready to run, their time would run out. And so they ask, is it possible to run on Saturday? And the answer was from the User's Advisory Committee, yes, we ought to be able to do that. And so we would take a consensus, is the beam on Saturday from 8 to usually 6 or so, was that to be 1 GeV or 800 MeV? Previously, there wasn't enough funding from the ring to have an operator come out and do that. But we asked that that be changed, and that was changed. There's always been a huge argument about who reviews the proposals. Number one, every proposal has funding from some agency to begin with, or the investigator would be here. And now being asked for another review by an outside group of 3 or 4 scientists who for a period of time remained anonymous, so they couldn't be killed. And you question whether a group of 3 might have the expertise all across all of the fields that would be investigated here, whether they could review. And so that was always contentious, but no one went through the formal process of actually requesting a review by the director. So that speaks well for it. And for a number of years, those outside reviewers were anonymous. And then one of the recommendations of the User's Advisory Committee is let us know who they are. Because it could be that you were doing some research that no one on that committee knew anything about. And so if you knew that, you could suggest a group of three or four who would know your work and know its significance, and maybe they would be contacted to advise one of the formal three or four. So the associate director has been the one who always makes the time assignments, and the director has been the one who just kind of oversees the whole operation.
Okay. Maybe talk a little bit about the start of Aladdin here. In my interviews that I've learned, that's kind of the whole right now is the start. Usually I have lots of information about Tantalus, and then it's like, and then Aladdin was built. And then, so I don't know a whole lot. So if there's anything you can think of.
Well, that was part of why I was telling you about the Microtron. Aladdin was built with insufficient funding. I think that's the kindest way of putting it. Most facilities would be $30 to $35 million. If I'm not mistaken, and Esther can check this, but the state provided the building, and they provided the concrete floor. I don't know whether you know, one of the reasons that this thing was built where it is the bedrock
is
underneath. So it's very stable base. But the ring itself didn't get more than about $3 million. And so virtually everything was built in the physical sciences shops. All of the magnets were built in that shop. In order to get uniformity in the magnets, they're made with various layers. All those layers were laid out and randomly mixed so that when you put a magnet together, you would hope that it would be just like its neighbor, because all of those things would have averaged out. And I don't know how many layers are in it, maybe 30 or 40 layers. But if one of them was heat treated one way and another heat treated another way, that could have caused a distortion in the field. And what most people don't quite understand is how difficult it is to get electrons particularly focused at a point in space. And so you have the bending magnets that change their direction, but you have all the focusing magnets to bring them back into focus as they have radiated some of their energy. Ed described the whole process as kind of like having a snake wiggle, and you force it to be in a particular position at a particular time, and you let it wiggle where it wants to in between.
Yeah.
And so the whole ring was put together on a shoestring budget. And the Microtron was built, this is the first Microtron. It was based on a radar concept out of Russia. Have you seen the Microtron?
Yes, I have.
So you know that it's two sets of magnets and a racetrack in between.
Yep.
And each pass that it goes through the magnet is given a kick in energy. So it starts out at 10 million electron volts, and it's 100 million when it finishes. Or to get past the resonance, it's a little higher in energy. Well, to make those electrons go around the bend and come back exactly to the center of those tubes was a feat of engineering to be able to do that. And as I said, when the whole thing was built, it was promised to be a 1-amp machine. It's never made 1 amp. Mm-hmm. 250 milliamps, maybe 300 milliamps was the maximum. Mm-hmm. And when it was first operated, 1 milliamp was all get out of. So there were several years when they were trying to figure out what was wrong, maybe two. The first year, they did everything that they could think of to do and just simply couldn't figure it out. And that's when the National Science Foundation canceled the funding. And it was another 9 months after that, with funding from WRF, that we were able to get that. Irv Shane was the person in chemistry who hired me. He went from the chair of the analytical division to the chair of the department, was provost for a while, went to Washington as chancellor, and then came back to Wisconsin as chancellor. And when he decided to spend the $1 million of war funding, he asked Georgia Margaritondo and me, should he do it? And we, of course, said yes.
Do you remember when this was? Roughly.
Let's turn off your recorder and go look.
Okay.
Radiation centers all across the country. That, I'm sure, is written down in some of the material that you got. It could be Giorgio's review of the Synchrotron Radiation Center. Have you seen anything that looked like that?
I don't recall specifically. I have lots of users' meetings.
There, you mentioned that Dave Lynch did one on Tantalus, mm-hmm. and Giorgio did one on this place.
Yes.
There's another thing of Giorgio's that talks about the key users.
Okay.
And what happened to them once they left here. And I think that would be an interesting thing to add. Because of their experience at this place, they were able to go at other places and be key people. This is when they were here either as graduate students or postdocs. I don't see it in here, but he did make that presentation.
Okay. So
keep, write that down, keep that in mind.
What was that one that you pointed out to me? There's the
User's Advisory. There's one on that tells you a little bit about the User's Advisory Committee and we did a user survey. There are two tabs, if I can get back to that.
There we are.
It's
under key.
It's tab P and tab Q. This describes the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, we did a survey of the users to show that they were satisfied. And somewhere in here, there's a description of the people who review the proposals and allocate the time, but you'll find it. There isn't an index for it. The index really is in the agenda. The thing, it was a nightmare. We put all this thing together, and the guy from NSF couldn't decide if particular things would be of interest to the committee or not. So we put an agenda together, and then we gave them about 3 alternatives for each 4-hour block. And at 8 p.m., the day before these presentations were to be made, they decided on what they wanted to hear. And so we put this booklet together on that basis. And we were working on it until nearly 1 in the morning. And then, of course, at 8 o'clock, presentations took off. So it was a little bit difficult.
Could you talk about Synchrotron as a whole compared to the other facilities in the States and why?
One of the major things that distinguishes the SRC is that it has been a lower energy facility. And what this means is that all of the other synchrotron radiation facilities, with the exception of one at the National Bureau of Standards, which the people here made and took to NBS, all of them have energies in X-ray and higher. 10 kilovolts, for example, rather than 800 and 40.
So 10 kilovolts will produce X-ray ranges?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anywhere from 1 to 15 would be in the X-ray range. One of the difficulties with that is that when you have a real high energy machine, you get the high energy radiation and everything lower. It's like a black body.
Yeah.
So you have all of the energies in that envelope. And the beauty to this place is that if you have a lower energy, then you don't have all of that high energy that you have to get rid of. And that high, all of that high energy can cause radiation damage, make your surface that you've tried to put together, that you're trying to study, damaged. And so this ring has been focused really on lower energy processes. Molecules on surfaces, And that's why we put together this focus to try to distinguish it. It's a study of valence electrons. Mm-hmm. When you have high energy, you can use core electrons. So this facility is focusing on that. And nanolithography uses soft X-rays for its imaging. And there's some studies back in the back of those things that can be done in that area.
So with the gentler energies, you can study valence electrons or something.
Right. Now, at other facilities, you can study the core and valence, but then you have difficulty sometimes separating out whether something is coming from a core, something coming from a valence. So the beauty here is that you remove some of that ambiguity. Angular distributions are another thing that comes from storage rings. The light is polarized, so electrons come out at a certain angle. And it's extremely important to understand bonding to look at the valence electrons, because that's what makes a chemical bond. And so if you look at the angular distribution, you can tell the type of bonding and also where it is in the energy spectrum. So when you see some of the big photoelectron spectroscopy analyzers, those are the big shiny dome things, you can put in a certain wavelength of light that's narrowly focused and look at a small slice of those photoelectrons that come out at a specific angle. And they will come out at angles that kind of look like your fingers. So it will be a lobe and a lobe and a lobe. And depending on the position of those lobes, you can tell a great deal about the bonding that's in that particular molecule. So that's been the focus here. And it's cheaper. It's cheaper to operate. The monochromators are perhaps easier to build because they have less heat that you have to get rid of. The resolution can be higher because you don't have all of the additional wavelengths that you have to worry about.
You had mentioned previously that when you won your award, you were being embattled with the West and the East. And to this day, I mean, you said at that time the NSF said that we can fund you all, but to this day, is there still competition between?
Not really. The advanced photon source at Argonne is a high energy facility, and so the East Coast has Brookhaven and it has Cornell as the major facilities. In the Midwest, the major high energy facilities are the advanced photon source. And on the West Coast, you have Berkeley and Stanford as two of those facilities. There is no competition for the lower energy rating. We're it. Mm-hmm. National Bureau of Standards has one that's about a 300 million electron volt ring, which is what Panels was. And it's used for calibration primarily. You can do some studies with it, but it's limited. I think in terms of valence electrons, this is the best ring in the whole world. And people from all over the world come for that reason. That's why we have a huge international distribution of users. In this facility, you can bring your own equipment, or you can use some of the equipment that the storage ring has constructed and has people who will teach you how to use it. Or you can make arrangements with a user to use their facilities to do some work. In this allocation of time, if someone comes and makes a major investment on the beam line, they have exclusive use for the first year or so. But after that, they have to share 25% of that time with someone who's been approved by this outside advisory committee. Now, the user has veto power. If there's somebody that just destroy the equipment, or someone that's directly competitive with, he can say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
But in general, it's been a very cooperative facility. Most of the other high energy facilities, people will come in for maybe 2 days or maybe a week. That's it. Most of the time allocated here is 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to get your samples set up, get it clean, get it prepared, and then do your experiments. The other facilities have a large group of users that rotate through the place. We have a smaller number of users that go through the place. User numbers is one of the metrics that the National Science Foundation looks at how effective are you. The other one is publications. And Franz talks about publications in his description here. How many we have done compared to some of the other facilities. And there's you a description of advanced light source, advanced photon source. This is at Cornell, and this is SSRO. And you can see that these numbers are not out of line.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of cost,
$5 million
versus $45 million
to
operate the facility. And so cost per paper, we come out way ahead.
So definitely the NSF has recognized that this low energy.
It's taken a while to get them to recognize. There was a ring in Germany, in Berlin, was competitive with us that has since been dismantled and another one built actually in East Germany, but it's much higher.
Mm-hmm.
So almost every ring has been higher energy. We used to be the Canadian National Synchrotron Radiation Facility.
Really?
Well, they had two beam lines that they were here, and they called us the Canadian National Synchrotron Radiation Facility. They set it up, and it was primarily for Canadian users.
So that's why I always hear the Canadian trailer.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And they used to fly the Canadian flag, the maple leaf, at the end of the beam line. They have since built a higher energy ring in Saskatchewan. So their high energy users are now in Canada. It's part of national pride. Mm-hmm. But I think there was 15 to 18 years that the Canadian National Synchrotron Radiation Facility was here.
And they left their beamlines here, correct?
They built the beamline, they built the monochronometer, they built the equipment that would be on the end of it. And they were reviewed, just like everybody else, but we primarily said, this is for Canada. There was a reciprocal arrangement. I don't know whether there was money that flowed from Canada to the National Science Foundation. It didn't flow to the facility, I know that. But it was a good cooperation. You know, they were very, very good neighbors.
So, like the synchrotron, are the other ones in the nation meant for international use, for any users to come and go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This has been a debating point. Our national facilities and our universities, should they be restricted to U.S. only? And graduate school, the answer has been hell no. It should be open to the best and brightest wherever. There may very well need to be a limit on how many foreign students that you would bring in, because if you get to the point that it's all foreign students, then you have no way of remaining competitive unless when the students graduate, they stay. And there have been some visa problems preventing that from happening. But the radiation facilities, in general, have been open to anyone, anywhere, who has a good idea that ought to be pursued, some significance that would be pursued. The one at Brookhaven had an arrangement with industry where an industry could purchase a line, put on their own equipment, and essentially do secret research on their beamline and not tell anybody anything. We, for a number of years, were prevented from doing that. And finally, the National Science Foundation said, it's okay. And so there is a rate that a user would have to pay to the facility if they did something that could not be reported in the open literature. I think the whole time that I can remember, there have only been something like 10 hours purchased at something like $200 an hour. So almost all of the effort is in the open literature. I think that's healthy.
Yeah, I would agree.
Eric, I've run out of.
That's great.
Think about it for a while.
I have plenty to go off of for now.
All right.